This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of God, the most merciful, the most compassionate. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam taslima. First of all, given that we're in Berkeley, I don't want anybody to hold it against me that I advise the president. So. I also would say that he did not take my advice. I just came from 6 weeks of touring. I was in the UK, I went to Denmark, and then to Qatar, where I was involved in what they called a high-level United Nations meeting there. And the United Nations was actually founded, according to its foundational documents, as an attempt to actually end war. After World War I, there was an attempt to found the League of Nations, which did not succeed. It was Wilson's dream. And he actually had a stroke during the Versailles Treaty. But it really never formulated or came to anything. But the United Nations was founded apparently to end war. What's interesting is that the five permanent members of the Security Council of the United Nations, beginning with the United States, are the biggest sellers of armaments on the planet. And it's a little like putting Jesse and Frank James on the board at the bank. You know, it's a very odd thing if you think about it, you know, that these people are the people that are supposed to give us security, and yet they're flooding the world with armaments. And I really believe that the great moral task ahead of us is to bring down the armaments trade. I think it is the great moral issue of the 21st century, in the same way that abolition was the moral issue of the 19th century, and in many ways civil rights was the issue of the 20th century. I absolutely believe that ending the arms trade, the global arms trade, is the moral issue of our generation. Whenever you see these wars, and Chris Hedges, and we have to honor him for his courage to do what he did. But whenever you see these wars, you should really know that the arms that they're using were not produced in those countries. Sierra Leone does not have armaments factories. Sierra Leone has diamonds. And diamonds buy weapons, because that's how the weapons were purchased in Sierra Leone. The seventh largest purchaser of arms on this planet is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia does not produce, it's a country of 19 million people, it does not produce armaments. It follows India, a country of over a billion people. Saudi Arabia has 19 million people, and yet it is the seventh largest purchaser of arms. Why? It doesn't use them. When they were threatened with invasion, they asked the Americans to come. So the reason is because it's a way of recycling petrodollars back into our economy. That's all it is. It's Raytheon's welfare. It's General Electric. We bring good things to death. Really, I mean, and we're all complicit. You know, we have lights, you know, GE, when you put that in there, we're supporting it. And that's, you know, that's the challenge that we have. And I don't envy the young people, because the world that we're offering them, you know, the world that we're handing over to our children, for God's sake, you know, I mean, I just feel like we should be doing something for these children. I look at my children, I've got a 7-year-old that's constantly asking me questions. And he recently asked me, if you had to choose, would you rather have a hot death or a cold death? And I don't know if he was referring to, you know, nuclear holocaust as opposed to the global warming that's actually making our weather in the Bay Area a little colder. But when I look at my child with his bright eyes and his total trust in me, and then I have to realize that he needs to come of age, he needs to leave the Garden of Eden and abandon that innocence and come to a realization of the type of world that has been handed to him. Much of it is defined by war. We don't like to think about the conflicts globally, but we are almost directly involved in all of the major conflicts around the globe. Somehow, this country, our country, the United States of America, we are a country of, like all great nations, immense paradox. And that's probably at the root of war, because war is paradoxical. On the one hand, nobody wants to go to war, or so we say. On the other hand, it's something that our culture revels in. The Great Generation. Tom Brokaw telling us about the Great Generation. The Great Generation bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki with nuclear weapons. The Great Generation is guilty of war crimes against huge civilian populations in Germany, Hamburg, Dresden. We don't like to think about that, because collectively all of the Germans were guilty. We demonized them. Not we, but the people before us. I was once in a grocery store, and it was a Time magazine cover. Somebody was buying it ahead of me, and it had a big mushroom, and it said, "Why did we drop the bomb?" That was the Time headline. And the lady ringing it up said, "Why did we drop the bomb?" And I just said, "Listen, I didn't have anything to do with it, all right? Nothing. I wasn't even born yet. And I don't like that implication, you know, of Time magazine." The Quran says, "Tilkal umam qad khalat laha ma kasabat." Those people are gone and they have what they earned. You know, previous generations. And this is part of the major problem that we have on this planet, is collective guilt, is this projection of guilt on to a collective group of people. What Erickson calls pseudo-speciation. It's a great word. I like words like that. Pseudo-speciation. Eric Erickson, the psychologist, said that pseudo-speciation is our propensity to basically otherize people, to deem them as less than human. It's what Hitler did with the Jews in Germany. They were less than human. Untermensch, I think, is the word. The Germans consider themselves Übermensch, you know, like a Superman, Nietzsche's Superman. So everybody else was Mensch, and then you had the less than human. I was once in Spain. We were going up a street in Granada, and very unusual person was asking for money on the street. And sometimes you see people and you really marvel at just their form and where they came from, the womb they came out of. It's fascinating. But I was struck by this person, and the person I was with is a Spanish man. He said, "Hay muchos infrahumanos aquí." You know, he said, "There's a lot of infrahumanos." That was the first time I'd ever heard that word. You know, less than human, which the person wasn't, but it was, that is pseudo-speciation. It's to deem somebody as less than human. And we can't go to war without doing that. You cannot go to war without doing that to other people. It's called Guantanamizing your enemy. Right? Guantanamizing your enemy. They have no rights. They're not human. They're terrorists. And terrorists are evil. And we're good. And therefore, by eliminating evil, we're doing something that is good. This is the justification. If you're not with us, you're with the terrorists, which was an attempt at paraphrasing Christ, who made a spiritual statement, he who's not with me is against me, which is a spiritual statement. But unfortunately, and this is a problem, I know that God once did speak through a bush, but we have... We have a president who's misunderstanding that was a burning bush. That wasn't a burnt bush. Right? That was a burning bush. You know, and that's the problem with this country, is that we're not setting our sights high enough, really. We're not aiming high enough as a people. And when you don't aim high enough, you either shoot yourself in the foot or you shoot your friend. That's a big problem that we've got in this country. You know, it's time that we really started setting our sights a little higher, because the foundational principles of this civilization are very high ones. And although, unfortunately, there were atrocities and there's terrible things that occurred at the hands of the early people in this country. But again, we did not inherit their evils, but we have benefited from their good. And it's very dangerous to demonize people because of some of their actions and not recognizing all of their actions. Because all of us are an admixture of good and evil. And in the melodramatic world of cartoons, where good is good and evil is evil. Oh, that was the cartoons I grew up. Now they're quite different. Superman lives in a parallel universe, and there's a negative Superman. So there's a whole other thing children are getting. But when I was growing up, and that was the time, you know, a little before me, George was growing up as well. And so, we were given cartoons where things were clear. Things were black and white. Good people wore white hats and bad people wore black hats, which is problematic for the Iranian mullahs, right? I mean, they really fit the bill, don't they? You know? I was actually just with Ayatollah Khatami in Qatar. He was at the UN. He has a PhD from Germany in German philosophy. Right? I mean, you know, people assume he's kind of a, you know, some kind of medieval throwback. I mean, the man is really far more sophisticated than a lot of rulers that we've had in the West. So this pseudo-speciation is what happens in the melodramatic universe. Now, what's interesting is we have a biological problem, because if you look at children, at about 7 months, a child, after an intense bonding with the mother, actually begins to recognize strangers and often will be frightened of them. They'll sometimes actually look and cry. And it happens to good people. It's not always, don't assume they're seeing something that you're not. Although they might be. Don't assume they're not. But this is what they do. They begin to recognize something that is foreign or alien. The family is the first in-group that we have. The family is our in-group. What's outside of the family is an out-group. When you go to school, you also have in-groups and out-groups. Our society thrives on this idea. As I was driving here, I was passing by these Phi Beta Kappa and, you know, these sororities and fraternities around Berkeley, which is a classic in-group, out-group phenomenon. When you join a fraternity, there's a hazing. You have to get, really drunk. I mean, they kill them sometimes, these poor people. But really, in hazing, people die in that initiation, that rite of passage. But you bond. Do you know, like George was in the Skull and Bones Club. And they have very intense bonding. They actually, you know, apparently have to go and dig up a dead person and spend a night in a coffin with a dead person. I don't know if those things are true, but people write about them like that. And it's very odd. But it's not, I don't think it should shock you, you know, if you've just seen, you know, the type of things that people are capable of doing. I mean, Chris talked about necrophilia. You know, lions don't do that. You know, monkeys don't do that. Humans do that, right? Really, we're capable of just immense depravity. But these in-groups and out-groups, this is the essence of war. Now, if you look at what is the foundation of war, where does it come from? There's people that, again, say, no, men don't like war, women don't like war. There's actually whole social theories that refute conflict theory, that war is thrust upon people. I don't believe that. We have a society that relishes war. Patton said anybody that says Americans don't like a war is a liar. Americans love a good war. I mean, that's General Patton. Now, he liked war, obviously. I mean, it was a passion with him. Really very intelligent man. I actually read his notes from World War II. It's called Our War. And on the very first entry, he just arrived at North Africa, and he said, just finished the Quran. He ended the entry by saying, just finished reading the Quran. A good book. Very interesting. So I thought that was, I mean, you know, nowadays, you just wonder about the generals nowadays. But he was going to a Muslim country. He wanted to work out what they were about. So you read a foundational book. If you want to understand America, I don't know what you would read. You know, I don't. I think you'd probably have to see a Quentin Tarantino film, right? To really, or go to, you know, big time wrestling, right? Go to one. I wonder where all those people come from in those big giant auditoriums. Are they walking around out here? Are they in the grocery stores with us? You know, you just have to want. I mean, if you want to inculcate peace, it's a very odd thing by teaching young children, you know, having these two. Wrestling used to be a noble thing. You know, two people got to, and they wrestled, and then they shook hands afterwards. They don't do that anymore. You know, they hit each other over the head with boards and smash their heads up again. It's supposed to be fake, but kids can't determine that. I mean, we had one poor 13-year-old boy jumped on this 5-year-old kid and killed him, shattered his spleen. And he got it from big-time wrestling. You know, that's why they have these big don't do this at home. And the only reason I know about big-time wrestling, it's very popular in Saudi Arabia. They actually really like big-time wrestling. And they're convinced it's real. I was once in a qahwa place and coffee house. And they were watching it, and I said, that's not real. And they said, no, it's real. Look. I gave up, you know. I mean, how do you argue with them? Look, he threw him down. He fell down. It's real. So, but promoting that type of a culture, because I really believe Abu Ghraib is a direct result. I call these guys Quentin Tarantino's children. They're kids that grew up on violence, on pornography, garbage in, garbage out. And I really was hoping for one, it was a bit of optimism on my part, but I was actually hoping that perhaps our country would just for a brief moment be able to recognize our shadow, just to see an aspect of our culture, of who we are, because we are Abu Ghraib. That is part of us. And to deny that, to say it has nothing to do with the United States of America is to deny our shadow. And Jung believed that the more you denied the shadow, the greater it grew. the greater it grew. Unless you were able, he felt it was like a seesaw, that the beautiful aspect of the human soul had to be in balance with the shadow. And if it wasn't, if you denied it, you elevated it. And what we do in war is we project our shadow onto others. This is what we do. All the despicable qualities that we hate about ourselves, we project them on the other. Do you see? The Arabs, you know, hate women. They're misogynistic. Look at some of the statistics in our own country. Pornography is the number one media industry in the United States of America. What does that tell us about our culture and how we view women? Because the Arabs that I know, they love women. Really. And I don't say that, you can interpret that as you like, but there's those type of Arabs as well. But every Arab learns from the time they're little children, al-jannatu tahta aqdam al-ummahat. Paradise is at the feet of the mother. That's what the Prophet Muhammad taught his community, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Paradise is at the feet of the mother. I know Arabs that would never greet their mother without kissing her hand and kissing her forehead. Would do anything for their mothers. Really. So we can project all of that darkness onto the other, and it enables us to demonize them, to treat them despicably, to carpet bomb them, to brutalize them, and things that Chris talked about in his talk that he's seen. I mean, I saw some of it in the refugee camps in Peshawar during the Afghani war against the Russians. Just the faces of the people. I mean, that's what happens when you demonize the other. It's just very easy to degrade, cover them in feces, violate them with sticks. I mean, this is what people can do. And what's interesting to me about war and religion, because it's a paradox, religion, of all the religions, Islam is most associated with militancy. It's seen as a militant religion. And there's certainly a militant aspect about Islam. Muslims are people. Solzhenitsyn said when he was in the Gulag in Siberia, and he wrote this, it's a very beautiful passage in one of his books. He said, of all the people in the Gulag, the one people that refused to be subjugated by the Russian guards were the Chechens. They would not submit to the humiliation. They always stood up and they would fight. And he said, and the unusual thing about this is that they actually gained the respect of the Russian guards. And the Russian guards had a type of fear of them. Chechens, the name for their capital, Grozny, is fierce. Tolstoy wrote a book about a Chechenian mujahid called Haji Murad, about the nobility of the Chechenian warrior. Chechenians are a very free and independent people. And one of the things that Islam teaches is never to be a slave of anybody but God. Never bow down to anybody. Honor people, respect people, but never allow a person to abuse you. That's at the essence of the Islamic teaching, because you have been ennobled by God according to the Quran. All of the children of Adam and Eve have been ennobled by God. We have a human dignity that is essential to our nature, our character. And in honoring that dignity, we must honor others. And in honoring that dignity, we do not allow ourselves to be dishonored. And the Prophet Muhammad said, a believer does not humiliate him or herself. So that's something very essential. And that's why the Palestinians are a resistant people. It's difficult for them. And even if they lash out in heinous ways, if you don't understand what is the essence of that,
then you're missing the point. You're missing the point. Because while I condemn the use of indiscriminate violence, I'm completely opposed to it, and I believe that blowing up buses in Tel Aviv is indiscriminate violence. I don't agree with it. I've always been against it. I've read arguments for it by certain scholars from the Middle East. I've never been convinced by them. But it happens. And the question that I think we're confronted with, Dostoevsky said it's very easy to hate those who do evil, but it's very difficult to understand them. And this is one of the great things about the poets and why we need the poets. Alden, September 1939, he was sitting in a dive in New York City when he heard about the invasion of Poland. And he said that scholarship could explain what was unleashed. He said, ask what happened at Linz. What unleashed that imago? A psychopathic god. I in the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. And that's a lesson that we need to learn. We need to learn that what we are seeing is a projection of ourselves. It's a projection of ourselves. And they also, they, me, we all need to see this on all sides. Because as long as we pseudo-speciate, as long as we deem the other as less than human, the kafir, right, the disbeliever, the infidel, justifying with that abuse of that other, then we failed to learn the essential truths of our tradition, whatever it might be. Because at the root of war is injustice, it's greed, it's selfishness, and it's a total lack of concern for the suffering of others. And all of those things religions came to free us from. And that's absolute truth. Whether it's Hinduism, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, they came to expose to us the worst qualities, our shadow, so that we might know ourselves better. And until we have greater self-knowledge, and this is what we're confronted with, an absolute imperative to have self-knowledge, because that's what this is about. It's about learning about ourselves through the lens of the other. Imam Shafi'i, one of the great scholars of Islam, was once asked, how did you get such excellent character? He said, I always listened to what my enemies said about me and I took it seriously. Our enemies have something to teach us. In Latin, the word enemy comes from inimicus, not friend, not friend. Somebody who's not a friend, which in the pre-modern world, that's the way it was viewed. The tribe and everybody else. There's a tribe in the Amazon called the Wari tribe, W-A-R-I. And their word, according to a linguist, Stephen Pinter, their word for dinner or for food is not a wary. Which he said was problematic if you were ever invited to have dinner with them. Being unwary. But that is the pre-modern world, the tribe. Do you see the tribe? It's me versus them. The Arabs have a proverb, me and my brother against my cousin, me, my brother, and my cousin against my neighbor, and me, my brother, my cousin, and my neighbor against everyone else. I mean, that's one view of the world. That's a view that our religions came to remove. Tribalism, provincialism, partisanship. Nationalism is a disease. It's a disease. And I don't believe patriotism is a disease. Love of your country is not a negative thing, it's a good thing. People always say, my country right or wrong, but they forget the actual quote. of the admiral that made that. He was a brilliant, extraordinary man. He was an early warrior he actually was in the War of Tripoli, Decatur. I think we have Decatur, Illinois, Georgia. They're named after him, Stephen Decatur or Decatur. I don't know how they say that. But in his famous toast, he actually said, "Our country, may she always be right. May she always be right in her foreign affairs. But our country, right or wrong." Very different to "my country, right or wrong." When our country is in the wrong, we need to stand by the truth. That is not tribalism. That is patriotism. Because that comes from love. It doesn't come from hate. It comes from love of your country. And that's why we're living in a time when dissent has become, once again, a dangerous word. A dangerous word. If you ask me, does God love war? I would have to say, I don't believe God loves war. War in the Quran is used 4 times, the word. It's a negative word in the Quran, harb. There are 2 times in which war is declared by God on people. When they engage in usury, which is considered an economic injustice, it's prohibited in the Torah, it was prohibited in church canon law, and Aristotle said it was the most unnatural form of money or wealth acquisition, condemned by all the ancient philosophers. And much of what we're witnessing around this globe is directly due to immense debt in these countries all around the globe that are paying exorbitant, usurious returns to industrialized countries that have lent them money, designed. Read Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Really, read that book. It's an important book about what we do and where that resentment comes, just trying to understand it at a deeper level. That's what we need to do. So, but God, according to the Quran, the Quranic narrative, there is a verse, "Inna Allah la yuhibbu al-mu'tadin." God does not love those who aggress. And there are 2 types of war. There is a war of aggression and there's a war of defense. And all of our religious traditions give people the right to defend themselves, whether it's Christianity with its just law theory. St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas believe that it was absolutely congruent with the teachings of Christianity, the right to self-defense, watching what they call the double effect, which is very stringent criteria for when good can cause evil. So collateral damage, carpet bombing, all these things. I mean, bombing people from the air. That's one of the things. We have a mechanism in ourselves that protects us from inflicting people with pain. It's called sympathy, compassion, pity. I mean, these are very powerful emotions that we acquire early on, usually given to us by our mothers. And when you distance, when you use weapons, where you drop bombs from 30,000 feet, there's no room for those inhibitors. There's no room for those constraints. So it becomes pushing a button. We don't see the results of what that button does. One of the things about and why books like The Unembedded are so important, and we honor Kale and people like her that are trying to bring these images to people. One of the reasons why they're so important is to see that true side of war, what it does to people, the effects it has on just the common people. One of the things that General William Westmoreland, who was back in the old days in Berkeley, he was called Waste More Land. He was one of the Vietnam generals. But General Westmoreland, who I think is famous for saying we had to destroy the village to save it, but he said, Vietnam was the first uncensored war. And when you don't censor war, it creates confusion in the public mind. What type of confusion? Because that's very Orwellian. What it creates in the public mind is moral conscience. An understanding that what we're doing is morally wrong. It's repugnant. And that is what we have to take it out. I really believe, and I think we should be inspired by the abolitionist movement, which began in the late 18th century, by 12 people in a small house in London. That house is still there. It's honored. When they began that, never did they believe in their wildest dreams that they would end slavery in their lifetimes. But they saw it. By 1732, the British had outlawed. By 1832, the British had outlawed the slave trade. It took some time to stop it, but they did it. And it was done by a handful of men and women committed to that, mostly working, in fact, really entirely working from the best of the Christian tradition. The best of the Christian tradition. And that movement took off. It was a great movement in the 19th century in this country. And I really believe that it's people like that that need to emerge from among us that are really willing to recognize that we are facing a choice between consciousness and catastrophe. If we don't wake up, we're on a perilous path to our own destruction. And we are the first generation, as it's been said many times, that has in its hands the capacity to destroy itself, our species. War is still a major threat. People are suffering from it all around the world. Nuclear proliferation is a major threat. Pakistan and India, disaster. Really, it's a disaster. Failed states. We have a lot of work to do. I really hope that people will take that home with them. And I hope we can have some more discussion and conversation. And I really, Chris Hedges, I read his book when it first came out, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. I really recommend to all of you that you read that book. It's an important book because in the absence of meaning, war is certainly one substitute. And our country right now is suffering from a vacuum of meaning and purpose. Consumerism just doesn't do the trick. You know, no matter how many trips to Walmart you make, those products never do what they say they're supposed to do. They just don't. It looks good in the store, and you get it home, and it's just, it just seems so different when I first saw it. You know, and before you know it, it's in some corner of the house, right? And then it's in the garage sale. So consumerism doesn't do the trick. And if you replace the sacred, it's always empty things that you try to fill that void with. God bless all of you. Thank you very much.